Sunshine now and 64 degrees.
It is 7:50 at AM 930 WEOL. I'm Bruce Van Dyke.
I'm Craig Adams.
It is the WEOL Morning Show, and this portion of the Spotlight on Oberlin is brought to you by Oberlin Hearing Care. Turn the key to better hearing. Call today or online, visit OberlinHearingCare.com. We have with us this morning Dr. Richard Hetzko. Good morning.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
And we're waiting on your partner, Dr. Josh Boyer.
Correct,
well.
Yeah.
Now, we've met him a couple of years.
Yeah, he's been out here, too, yeah.
Yeah. How's he been working out for you?
He's been doing fine. He just became a dad last year, though, so he's got a one-year-old running around the house and That's why he's not here, probably chasing her around.
Now he's going to have to sort of put into practice those things he learns about infant hearing, or is he going to be too worried?
Oh, he's watching her already.
Okay, right.
But she's developing her speech fine. She's doing okay, and he's training a young audiologist
right now,
as we speak.
What do you look for those people, those ages? You know, the kids. What
developmental milestones?
Yeah.
Well, at 1 year, we expect them at least to be saying one or two words like mama, da-da, bye, go, something like that. And then gradually after that, we expect them to just accumulate more words and putting more words together like go bye-bye or go for a walk, that kind of thing. By the time they get to age two, they start to pick those things up. And then after that, it just kind of cascades. The language develops as age three, four goes on. They just develop more language and more vocabulary. But at one, we should at least be seeing some words. But on the other hand, I had a neighbor when I lived in Elyria many years ago who had a 18-month-old daughter, hadn't been saying anything. And she asked me what to do. I said, well, let's take her to the Northern Ohio Special Education Resource Center and just have them take a look at her. And she said the day before she was supposed to go there, this little girl started to go a mile a minute. You know, not just one word, two and three word statements. It was like she was just waiting to somebody paid attention to her. So some kids go at their own pace.
I had nothing to say until that time. I was just observing this whole new place, a lot of things going on there as well. It's amazing how you think really hearing and speech are so tied together.
Absolutely.
And it's one of the keys to let you know. How often are people supposed to come in and get their hearing checked?
Well, with children, it depends. But if we start seeing children who have delayed speech and language, and certainly in the schools they used to screen hearing when the children would go to school at age one or age five, I mean. Now, though, hospitals are screening infants in the nursery, in the NICU, or in the neonatal care unit, just because there's a state law that mandates that. So every child, before they're released from the hospital, has a hearing screening performed to see if they have a hearing loss at birth. Because something like 4 out of 1,000 children will have some kind of hearing deficit at birth. Now, a lot of children also will develop a hearing deficit after that, so that's why it's quite nice to screen them if you start to notice any developmental delays with speech and language. And certainly the schools used to screen them at kindergarten or first grade just to see where their hearing was. And then after that, as needed, based on their language development and language delay.
As the child is growing, ear infections take place. I don't know if it's so common or if it's, you know, I don't know anybody who maybe didn't have one at some particular point. How does that impact their development?
That has a big effect, yeah. Up until about third grade in school is when the ears finally start to develop a more an adult size shape internally. The Eustachian tubes, which ventilate the middle ear, when we're born, they're more horizontal. But as our head grows, they become more at an angle vertically. And that allows, when they open and close, to drain mucus and let air up into the middle ear space. But if you have children who are, let's say, bottle-fed on their back, if they have colds, upper respiratory infection, those tubes don't open, and consequently the ears don't ventilate, and then these middle ear infections evolve. And if they get to the point where they're depressing the hearing, which they can, then they can have an impact on speech and language development. So we watch that very carefully with young kids.
Can those infections be more seasonal or no?
Yes, usually we see them between October and May. When the kids are inside, they're in school, there's more closeness in terms of germs being brought home by siblings and so forth, that's when we see them. And then in the summertime, when kids are out and they're not in school together, they're not locked in, they tend to do better.
All right, let's fast forward to a number of years older people. At what point do you notice if there's a hearing loss, or what are symptoms of things to think, you know, I should get my hearing checked, or I'm doing things to compensate for loss of hearing?
Well, if you find yourself asking people to repeat again, or if you find yourself putting your hand up to your ear when you're listening, especially in a crowded restaurant or something, if you find that you're turning the TV up higher than the rest of the family would like, Those are often indicators that you're not hearing well. Now, most people don't have a problem with their hearing per se as much as they have a problem with communication. And all that means is that they may have a little drop in their hearing, and what that does is it impacts their communication in certain situations, usually in noisy situations or group situations when the sound conversation is bouncing back and forth, and there's enough background noise to kind of impede your ability to hear what's being said. And sometimes even people with normal hearing who are older will have trouble in that situation because of changes in the brain. So when you start having difficulty with communication, it's usually a good time to have your hearing assessed. Age 50 isn't a bad time to have it checked for the first time just to get a baseline. And after that, as needed, is when you should have it checked.
All right. I need to bring up the whole Yanni Laurel thing that's been going on. Now, I don't know whether this is a boon then for audiologists or people who want to get their hearing checked at all, but it kind of brought forth how people hear things differently.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Dr. Boyer just got here. Do you want to address the Yanni Laurel situation, Josh?
Hey, good morning. How are you doing?
Good. We're great.
Well, you know, that's been something interesting that's, you know, been happening the last couple of days anyway. But it all has to do with how we perceive sound and how changes in our hearing can change how we perceive different words or different sounds. Now, that sample is a very doctored sample, you know, as far as if someone just says to me, Laurel, I don't hear Yanni. But right. But depending on how we hear sound, it changes how we hear that sound sample.
I wondered how it impacts us sort of socially or ourselves. Sometimes you're thinking, if I'm the only one that hears this way, something wrong with my hearing? Or am I superior to them because I hear something different? It has a whole other kind of context to the way that it plays out.
Yeah, I think I told you before we came on the air that I listened to two different recordings on two different sites. And the first one, I clearly heard Laurel. The second one I heard is something like Yerny, not quite Yanni. But my feeling was it had to do more with the recording or the way that sound was reproduced on those recordings. Because in flat-out conversation, if I'm talking to you like this, if I say Laurel, it's going to be awful hard for you to hear Yanni. But I think in recording conversation, it's more likely that that's going to happen because of all the things that can go wrong or can be changed in the recording process and the reproduction process. At least, you know, that's what I was thinking.
Right. You kind of mentioned how you have a visual. There's two parts to hearing, what you hear and then what you see while you're hearing it, to put it in context, right?
Right. And I was reading that, excuse me, that if you read the word or if you heard the word Yanni or Laurel before you heard that sample, that heavily dictates which one you hear because it gives you a primer before you listen to the sound sample. But there's also a really great tool that I found out there, and I think the Times came out with it, but it's a slider where you can change the frequency of that sound sample. If you take it up in pitch, you hear, I mean, hear clear as day one sound. If you take it down 30 hertz, take it down in frequency, you can hear both just by changing the frequency of what that sound sample is going.
What kind of things do you do when you're testing people's hearings to sort of determine what it is they hear or don't hear? We've had the ones where you put headphones on, you hear, you know, what ear do you hear? Do you hear this frequency? I mean, what kind of tests do you do to determine what people have as far as their hearing ability and deficits?
Well, there's a lot of tests out there that help with to determine, you know, what someone hears versus what they don't. You know, basically, the gold standard is, you know, audiometric testing, so using pure tone frequencies on a spectrum to find out what the threshold of hearing is for a person at any given frequency, with the frequencies that are the most important for speech. So we can look at then what's called an audiogram to see what someone's thresholds of hearing are to determine, you know, how that can change what they hear. So that's basically, you know, the first and foremost thing that we do, you know, to test hearing. There's also speech testing that will give us an idea of, you know, if someone hears a sound that we know they can hear it at any given frequency, how well do they perceive that word, or how well do they perceive a list of 50 words. We can also do that in noise. We can do that in a number of different situations to see, you know, how not only what they would hear or what they hear as a threshold, you know, basically as an objective test, but also how they might perform in noise or how they might perform hearing different words or hearing different sentences.
And there are numerous other what we call electrophysiologic tests that don't even require your participation, where we can attach electrodes to the scalp, we can generate certain types of sounds into the earphones and measure electrophysical activity of the brain. and determine, in many cases, get a pretty good idea of what hearing is like without the participation of the person involved.
Yeah, it's incredible. The auditory brainstem response is something that is used pretty widely in Ohio for newborn infant hearing screenings. So many newborns, as soon as they're born, within the first day, they're tested audiologically with this auditory brainstem response. When my daughter was born last year, I actually got to watch her have this test performed, where they stick these big red and blue electrodes all over her head, and they send a sound sample through her ears, and they measure the latency of the auditory pathway from the ear up to the cortex. It's incredible.
It's awfully hard to get them to raise their little hands.
I wonder if sort of hearing is moving from the ear to the brain as far as resolving issues or treating it, in a sense?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we hear both with our ears and with our brain. So in that way, just like the Laurel and Yanni, the primer, if you hear one word, if you hear the sample, or if you read the sample before you hear it, it can highly dictate what you end up perceiving from that sample.
Yeah, the ear breaks the sound down and then feeds it to the brain, and the brain basically slices and dices it then. It, in a sense, it's sort of like digitizing speech and then reassembling it again. And depending on the type of situation you're in when you're listening, that can have effects on how you hear. And it all starts in what we call the peripheral auditory pathway, the inner ear itself. When that breaks down, it's feeding less information to the brain, so the brain's getting an inaccurate picture of the life out here. And then it has to try to figure out what's being said without knowing what's being said. So we have a lot of people who have high-pitched hearing losses and sounds like S, T, F, soft TH, sen, thin, fin. If you hear them in context, you know exactly what those words are. But if I take a patient, put a paper over my mouth, and I say those same three words, and they have a high-frequency drop in their hearing, they'll come back and say, you said thin. I said, no, I said sen, thin, fin, but you couldn't hear it because you didn't have any other context, and your hearing in that region is not right anymore. And it's very subtle, and a lot of people confuse 56 and 66, especially over the telephone, because they're high-pitched sounds that are very close together. And if you start seeing those kinds of problems, you may have a little high-pitched hearing loss that's starting to develop.
What do corrective devices do then to make us hear those sounds?
So what they do is using the testing that we gather, we program the hearing aids to accentuate the frequencies that someone's missing out on. So instead of a basic amplifier that amplifies everything like our television sets, we turn it up, or like these headsets, you turn it up, it turns up everything on a 1-to-1 ratio across the frequencies. You have a frequency specific device that we can use to, instead of making things louder, we can make them more clear. Instead of making everything boomy, we make things more easily understandable. So someone can pick up the S, that T, and different sounds that they're missing out on, without having everything else come up with it. It's pretty interesting. I see a lot of our patients with purely high frequency deficits. They report that things don't sound much louder. When we put them on for the first time, they go, "Wow, this. I don't know if this sounds much different." But when they go out into their environments and they start talking with people and they start talking in noisy situations, they start to pick up on patterns where they say, "Oh, okay. So, whereas I wasn't having as good of a time in the situation with noise before, and now I'm picking up more of those speech sounds. Now I'm able to kind of keep up with the conversation a lot more."
Does it fluctuate so that if things are not as cacophonous, it won't make everything, crazy? It'll kind of lower it down. So if it's in a quiet setting, it will have a feeling like that too?
Correct, yeah. So, say you're in a quiet setting at home, you've got an air conditioner running, a refrigerator in the kitchen. The hearing aids, what they do is when they notice, they're always listening to different situations. These days, the technology is amazing for what they can do to process listening situations and choose different listening profiles that work best for that environment. So for a quiet environment, for example, they'll use expansion to quiet down on the background sounds. They'll actually tune themselves down a little bit so that you don't, so that you're not as aware of low-level background noises like machine noise, right? Air conditioners, things like
that. Craig, we need to get some of these back. I would just wear these things.
Oh, yeah.
There's points, and I don't know, you probably experienced this, you get a power outage or something stops, you suddenly realize how noisy the world is.
Oh, my gosh.
Until you think, oh, that's what quiet seems like.
Yeah. Exactly. Now imagine a world where you didn't realize you weren't hearing those sounds. And then all of a sudden we put a device on and you're hearing all that background noise again. It can be really disconcerting for someone who's gone a long time with a hearing loss that hasn't done anything about it, because you're all of a sudden they're getting all this stimulation from a world that they're not used to. So the hearing aids both try to bring in the sounds that they need to communicate, but also not make things so cacophonous that that it's overstimulating for their senses.
How does this help their, does this impact their balance in any? Because sometimes we think hearing and ears in balance are just sort of movement is connected to that.
No, there was some research done that suggested that, and then I just read a paper the other day that said, not so fast. We're not sure that it does. But some people think that if you're, imagine you're walking down the street and you have a hearing problem, and you're trying to listen to somebody who's talking to you outside and the wind's blowing, and you're trying to watch them and listen to them, you're assigning most of your brain power to listening and not paying attention to where you're going. You might trip, you might fall, you might say, gee, is that a balance disorder? Maybe not. But in terms of an actual pure effect on balance, unless it's a physical malady like Meniere's syndrome or what we call endolymphatic high drops, where the inner ear is affected, hearing imbalance, hearing doesn't necessarily affect balance, at least by most standards right now.
Wow, a lot of great things going on. If people want to, you know, get their hearing checked by either one of you or find out more information, where's a good place to get some of that?
Well, they can go to OberlinHearingCare.com to learn more about us, or they can call our number at 440-774-5819. Is that it?
That is correct. Okay. You can also check us out on Facebook. Come on over, like our page. I try to keep relevant information there, hearing health, stuff like that.
Sounds good. Well, we appreciate both of you stopping in, and congratulations on the newborn.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah,
thanks
shameless
for having
plug.
Us.
I'm still wondering, curious, because of the fact that you're a doctor, did they let you look at that particular test that they did on your child, or is it one sort of thing like
they
that?
They kind of looked at me funny when I asked to watch the testing. You know, I asked, you know, do you do ABR? Do you do otoacoustic emissions?
See, throwing in some of those words.
Yeah, you know, and they kind of look at me and go, why don't you come back and
we'll
watch
show you.
We do that thing where we stick it on there. Sometimes they don't even know.
Right, what do you do for work again?
One of those. Well, again, Josh Boyer joining us, Dr. Josh Boyer, and also Dr. Richard Hetzko.
Thank you, guys.
From Oberlin Hearing Care, OberlinHearingCare.com. We've got more